Hi, everyone. This is John Campbell again, calling on BBC, BBS Radio. I do apologize. I'm your host for this afternoon's welcoming show, The Miracle Hour. And this afternoon, this is a great opportunity for all you people out there who are interested in getting some miracle relationships in your life, because my guests today are the international speakers and educators on relationships, Shauna McGee and Maurice Taylor, based out of Sausalito in California. And if you'd like to call into the show today, remember you can call toll-free from USA on 877-876-5227, or from Canada on 888-815-9756, and from anywhere else in the world on 1-530-876-3222. So, relationships. I know nobody out there has any problems with relationships. I think that, I really hope that some of our young listeners are out there today, because when I first came upon Shauna Maurice's work probably about 5 years ago, it was so stunning and so dramatic, and it's unique. I think it's very unique. And they've written a couple of wonderful books. They're going to tell you about that. So, welcome to the show, Shauna Maurice. It's great to have you here.
Thank you, John.
Thanks, John. It's great to be here.
Yeah, it is really, and I'm just picturing you down there in Sausalito, and the weather is good there?
You know, it's sparkling. We have a beautiful pre-summer day here, and I say that because our summer here in Sausalito in San Francisco usually comes in around September, October, so.
Oh, that's wonderful. Well, you know, what I'd like to do, first of all, I mean, to talk to us this afternoon a little bit, first of all, about how you guys met, because that's quite a fascinating story about the paths that you were intending to go on. Would you like to tell our listeners, Shauna and Maurice, about how you guys hooked up eventually?
Sure, John. It is a great story. Shauna and I were students in graduate school in the late 80s, actually 1987-88, and we've seen each other around campus.
Oh, we've got a technical problem again.
Oh, pardon me?
Technical problem.
You tell me. Can you hear me, John?
Well, listeners, we've got a little bit of a technical problem. We'll get it sorted out very shortly, I'm sure.
Okay.
We heard a bit on our end, too.
While we're waiting for that, I'll just talk to you a little bit about Shauna Maurice. They wrote a book called The New Couple, The 10 New Laws of Love. And they will be telling you about that as soon as we get hooked back up again. Hello?
We're here. Can you hear us, John? Hello? 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 We hear you.
Hi, Maurice. Hi, Shauna. Have I got you there? Maurice? Shauna?
We're here.
Oh, okay. We got you back again. Sorry about that little bit of a technical problem there. Just at the moment when we were getting to the exciting part, when you were going to tell our listeners just about how you guys hooked up, how you met, because I know it's a very interesting story.
Sure, John. Let's see. Where were we? Late 80s, Shauna and I were in graduate school together.
Here in San Francisco.
And we'd seen each other around campus for that first year, 1987. In 1988, we ended up in family therapy class together. And it was,
oh,
it was just a lovely meeting because,
yeah,
you know, we had a slew of judgments about each other.
That's unusual, huh?
Exactly. It was like a romantic comedy from the 1940s, you know, when the protagonists hate each other until the moment they fall in love.
But, you know, can I just ask you to back up there a little bit, though, because what I really wanted you to share with the listeners was the incredible story that where your paths were taking you, which was completely opposite direction.
Well, John, you must be referring to our career paths.
That's it.
Yeah, and, you know, I was headed into a path in politics, and Shauna in a path of journalism. And go ahead, honey.
Well, right, exactly. Well, there was a bit of an overlap there because I had been wanting to work for the United Nations. I had a background in journalism, and I had I applied to the United Nations as a press officer, a bilingual press officer in New York, and I went through a whole process with them. Which was pretty grueling and very, very competitive. And I ended up in the position of being chosen for this position that had been vacated by somebody who had committed suicide on the job.
Oh, my God.
Which was amazing.
Oh,
but I saw while I was at the UN, really to my tremendous dismay, just completely, it seemed to me, rampant interpersonal conflict.
Right, that's the part I really, thank you, Shauna, because that's the part I wanted to get through to the listeners, was that you were actually shocked, I believe, both of you as well, Maurice, at the kind of interpersonal relationships that you found in that workplace. Was that correct?
Yes, and it wasn't even necessarily country against country, but there was that prejudice there too. There were problems between superiors and subordinates within the bureaucracy of the United Nations that were very, very obvious. And I was even taken to task quite severely by a group of women from Africa because I was talking about more or less white feminist agenda. And
oh,
I thought, even women are against women here.
So it was quite a shock, a culture shock to you. And then was it the same for you, Maurice?
John, it was a terrible shock for me. And in part, perhaps due to my naivete, I ended up right out of high school being an intern at a congressional office in Washington, D.C., working for actually Leon Panetta, who ended up being Bill Clinton's chief of staff for several years. And I went to Washington a little bit like Mr. Smith in the little film, John. I thought that Washington was going to be a place where people were actually concerned about building bridges and connections to each other rather than walls and fences. And I was absolutely shocked. By, again, it's not just the sort of classic, you know, party politics, but I was shocked at the interpersonal conflict, the warfare, the virulence of the way in which people treated each other, and it was a terrible kind of a de-idealization for me. I had a little bit of that Robert Kennedy, John F. Kennedy idealization of Washington D.C. and political leaders. So I was quite shocked by it all, and I came back from that experience, really on a completely different course.
And I
wow.
went straight back to graduate school. I thought, well, if that was the height of my journalism career, functioning as a mouthpiece for the United Nations, then, you know, what can I do now to start addressing interpersonal conflict on a micro level? And
right.
I figured I would go back to graduate school and get my degree in psychology and try to figure out what made, you know, the basic microcosmic, you know, dyad of all relationships, which was the mother-father dyad, to study that and see why couples click or why they collide and see what I could do on that level. And that's where I met Maurice in family therapy class.
Wow. But isn't it fantastic, though, how the infinite works? Like, you know, you had to go those routes to get really you know, teed off with it and then really get a shock to your system, and then it both drove you into meeting each other at graduate school.
Yes, and John, believe me, the last thing I was looking for was a husband.
Until you saw Maurice.
Well, when I met Maurice, I told him, well, we'll go out for a few months, but I'm really, really interested in my career and I don't want a relationship.
Oh, that's so cute. That's so cute. And were you guys instantly attracted to each other, or?
Well, John, that's what I was starting to say earlier when I was telling you the story. I mean, we basically had a slew of judgments. We had a load of judgments about each other. You know, we looked like archetypes at that time. I had long hair. I looked like a young hippie kid. And Shauna was very preppy, and she looked like a little Eastern Seaboard, you know, young yuppie. And here we met, and, you know, it was really a clash of cultures. So, you know, we learned later, had judgments about each other for that whole first year. And, you know, we were going to the California Institute of Integral Studies, which is a very forward-thinking, kind of progressive east-west graduate school in psychology here in the Bay Area. And I was thinking to myself, you know, what is this school doing letting these yuppie, you know, these preppy girls in? They should be cheerleaders.
And I thought, why are they letting hippie children here? I'm paying big money for this education.
So how did you break that ice then?
Plus, there was a rumor that Maurice was gay, which I didn't even question. So that when he kind of started flirting with me, I thought, this is very bizarre. Why is he acting this way with me? And also, actually, in our first conversation, he showed a knowledge of feminist ideology and philosophy that was beyond my own, and I was so surprised and impressed.
Oh, wow. So Maurice, he already sort of had some enlightenment in that area, is that right?
He's brilliant. I mean, he could,
wow,
he could expostulate on it. And I was very, very impressed, and I could see that he has a massive, massive heart to match his intellect. And we won't talk about his looks.
Oh, okay. That is so nice. Well, that's fantastic. And so you got together then, and you started to date each other, I guess. And then when did it first work? Because what I'd like you first to share with the listeners is your concept, because that really blew me away. When I just that basic three stage of every relationship, and you know, guys, I can tell you, I have watched that three stage work out in individuals, in groups, in the workplace, and it never fails. It's spot on. So can you share that three stages?
Sure, John. You know, just to back up one moment, I mean, the most amazing thing about our relationship from the very beginning was that we started working together as a team with couples. We started co-counseling couples, conjointly it's called. The very first month we were dating, we started our first internship and we started working with couples.
And families.
And families. But we started working this as a team and just found even though our relationship would have its ups and downs, we would be able to show up in that room with couples or a family and just, you know, just drop into a kind of zone and really show up and be present for those couples and families we were working with, those people we were working with. So that was just a cool gift from the universe, from the gods to us, I think.
Yeah.
You know, it's what we call a dharmic relationship, that Shauna and I were put here to not only be together and have fun together and co-create on a personal level, but we were put here to do some work together.
Yeah. So you felt that was evident very early on.
And it was our bliss to do so.
Right. Wow, that's fantastic. That must have been a fantastic experience.
Well, it just was, John, and what we started doing, and this sort of leads into your question, what we realized in the very beginning was that we needed something additional to what we were being taught in order to keep our love healthy and vibrant.
And wow, so that was a great motivator.
It was a great motivator.
It wasn't just for our clients, it was also for us.
It was for us.
I mean, like, we were happy to admit that.
Yeah.
Important.
Well, that's one of the things that I love about you guys. You know, I've always experienced you very open and very, very honest about the fact that you know, you continue to work on yourselves, and your commitment to that is fantastic. And I think that's such an important thing in the field.
Thank you, John.
And you know, and that brings us to the creation of our model and understanding the phases of relationship. Because, you know, there are three phases to relationship. discrete phases, the first being intoxication or the honeymoon phase, the second one, which we call the power struggle phase, and the third, which most couples don't realize in terms of achieving it, is called the co-creativity stage. And, you know, it's very important to understand that all intimate relationships do go through these predictable phases, that the honeymoon phase does end, is supposed to end, and that it's not true that we're supposed to be in a state of intoxication, that is characteristic of a healthy relationship. That's not at all true.
Right. So that was a really big one, isn't it? Because in a way, you know, we have as a society been sold this big romantic myth, you know, the kind of, you know, white horse going off on the sun to the sunset, and it's simply not true, is it?
Well, not only is it not true, John, but as Shauna says, it's very destructive. And, you know, it's actually also a lie, because that first stage of relationship is based on a distortion. It's called an idealization distortion, where the person opposite us actually appears to be greater than they are. It's not a perception, an accurate perception of who they are. And so, I mean, it's just a really, really important fact about that early stage of relationship, so that when that changes and we start seeing them, you know, more for who they are, another force kicks in and we start distorting them in a negative way. We start devaluing them, which is also a lie. That's not who they are either. And so both the intoxication stage and the power struggle stage are based on a distortion of perception. And until we get to co-creativity and begin doing some of the work of relationship, which we're going to talk about in a few moments, until we begin that really important, very essential work, we actually have a distorted perception of ourselves and our partner.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Okay. So, and in your experience, are there varying lengths of time that first stage lasts? I mean,
yes.
In your experience?
Yes, I would say 2 weeks to 2 years. And I think the older and more conscious people are, the shorter that period is.
Because the more conscious they are, Shauna, or the more unconscious?
More conscious we are, the shorter the intoxication period is.
Stage, John, yes.
Right, okay. Is that because they kind of feel safe to start getting into the stuff?
They're just aware of their own predilection for going into that kind of drug fantasy state. They don't trust it anymore.
Right.
They're too wise.
They can't be as easily seduced into an idealization.
I mean, we know, you know, we eventually learn the hard way that that being with another person is not going to heal all of our personal trauma and all of our low self-esteem issues.
Right. Okay. So really, that's another thing I just wanted to clarify with you. Would you say that your concept is based on the fact that the purpose, because this is what blew my mind, was that the whole idea of this intimate relationship is really to heal our wounds?
John, that's absolutely right. I mean, it's a very interesting thing. You know, as I was thinking about this radio program with you today and understanding that really that the Course in Miracles is your point of reference for this exploration, it occurred to me that there was just a very natural confluence. And, you know, and that is this, that yes, the intimate relationship, it catalyzes our hurts, our wounds, like nothing else on planet Earth. It pushes in our face the places where we're unhealed, where we're fragmented, where we're fractured, where we're hurt from the past. And it forces us to either heal those parts of ourselves or lose the relationship, essentially. That's the choice.
Right.
Yes. So we, in a way, we learn through our beloved all the places where we are separate from God.
Right.
So we're not in union. And in a way, we could say it's a very spiritual path to sit in, you know, on a mountaintop in Nepal and contemplate our navels, as it were, but the truth is that the more rigorous spiritual path has always been the householder path. Staying together in peace and love and harmony has to be one of the most challenging human undertakings.
Yeah, right.
We are going to be healing ourselves and noticing, as Maurice said, where we're wounded, traumatized, and, you know, really irrational. And we talk a lot about states of regression where we're triggered into a child subpersonality and our adult is not present. And I think in a way that's what happens in the intoxication stage of relationship. The excitement of meeting somebody new and the promise and joy of that triggers us into a child fantasy space, and we are not functioning from our full adult personality. And we actually interpret all the problems couples have interpersonally as problems of regressing and not being in adult with each other.
Yeah.
And in terms of,
and of course, the shocking thing that so many are not aware of any of this stuff. I mean, you know, if I hadn't got into this work, you know, I mean, well, I hadn't until I was in my sort of early 50s, and I'm thinking, wow, this should be taught in high school. I mean, that's what I believe.
Yes, John. Well, absolutely. I mean, there's just no question. You know, the difficulty is that until we have that experience of a safe haven, of a secure base, that most of us don't come out of our childhoods with. You know, most of us have an attachment that is somewhat insecure coming out of our childhoods. And so what happens is that there's both a fantasy that this other person is going to make us whole, and then there's the horrible reality that they're not. That not only are they not going to make us whole, but they are adding to our misery. So, you know, part of what can happen in committed monogamous relationship is we can get an experience of what's called earned or learned secure attachment. And from that secure base, that safe haven, you know, we can go on and do the great work in the world, whatever that is for us, including, in course parlance, being able to, you know, forgive, to be able to really identify that we're not separate from everyone else. When we're fragmented or insecure about our base, about our sense of safe haven, it's very difficult to do any kind of spiritual work.
Right. Okay. Well, that's great, because that brings me on to another question, and I just want to flag this for later on to bring it in, because, you know, the way that your work integrates with A Course in Miracles, because, you know, I think there can be a very subtle misunderstanding with the Course, that, you know, that you just don't need to go and do this kind of work that you're talking about, and you just simply go to forgiveness and everything's okay. But that's not my experience, in my own experience, and I think for me there has to be an acknowledgement and a reparation, if you like, of the wounds, and then going to forgiveness. Would you go along with that?
I would totally agree, John, and I was starting to say that, you know, just the Course is a very, very rigorous spiritual path. You know, it demands a completely platinum standard on earth.
Yeah.
And the truth is that most people are incapable of that kind of standard. They're incapable of that kind of experiencing the other as not separate from oneself, especially when they're perceiving that other as hurting them. You know, that's where the rubber hits the road, isn't it? That's where it's really difficult. You know, understand that this person who I'm experiencing as an antagonist, this person who's hurt me, or in our world, in our relationship world, you know, a partner who's been vicious or who's been, you know, harsh with us, you know, to see them as really, you know, no separate, no different from ourselves is very difficult work. And that's why we bring it back to what Shauna was talking about, which is the whole idea of regression. The Course likes to talk about the ego. We just like to talk about the child. That makes
okay,
a lot
so, so
more...
the child is equal to the ego.
Exactly.
In a way, but we kind of skirted the terminology, the ego, in our teachings, because when you hear child, it brings up much more compassion and heart. Where ego, I think ego at this point has a very bad rap. Oh, that's
yeah, right.
So, well, it's our child. It's an unhealed child part that needs to be loved and parented and properly raised, which, by the way, is the undertaking, the healing of our own inner child is the way we move from the power struggle phase of relationship into co-creativity, especially using certain tools that we teach couples. I just didn't want to leave people hanging. How do we get into co-creativity? You said we, you know, most people never get there. That's how we do it. We undertake to earnestly reparent our own inner child self.
Right. Okay. And so in that stage, this is when you wrote the book, The New Couple, The 10 New Laws of Love. And would you like to share, you know, what that is exactly, what the laws are?
Sure, John. I mean, the model is really predicated on this idea that when people come together in a genuine way, that there's chemistry there. When people come together and they really like each other, when there's a spark, when there's an affinity and attraction, there's chemistry. And we talk about two kinds of chemistry that are essential for all romantic relationships, and that is a best friendship chemistry. That's some kind of a harmony on the friendship level, where you just have this experience that this other person is a great person, that you'd like to spend time with them, that they're fun, that they're safe, that they just they feel like they could be a potential best friend. It's not that anybody's best friend on first meeting, but you have that sense that this person is fabulous. And, you know, many people say to us all the time, when I met my partner, you know, I knew that right away that even though I hadn't spent more than 10 minutes with this person, you know, I knew this person in a way better than I did people I've known my whole life.
Right, okay.
That's
friendship
chemistry.
And possibly that person knows us better than anybody. I remember even with Maurice thinking, I didn't know that this kind of just resonating with another person existed. I never thought I could get along with somebody this well. It seemed impossible to me. It was beyond my imagining.
Yeah. So that was a real kind of eye opener to you both, then.
Yes.
Well, and John, see this, and this is the beginning of the model. So that's the best friendship chemistry. Then there's sexual chemistry.
It's the first law of love.
Right. It begins with chemistry, and we're starting there. And the sexual chemistry is just that. It's that, you know, our bodies seem to love each other. You know, there's just a harmony. There's a resonance there on a sexual or physical level that seems independent of our minds. Now, there can be negative chemistry. There's no question about it. Certain people are only aroused by people that are, you know, self-destructive for them.
Emotionally dangerous.
But we're actually not talking about that now. We just want to throw that caveat in because it's an important one. So our system, our model builds on chemistry. As Shauna said, it's the first law of love. It's the only law that we can't teach. We can't teach chemistry.
Uh-huh.
So in our work, often we're helping couples determine whether they have chemistry. I mean, chemistry does wane over time, especially if the best friendship starts getting a little bit beaten up due to a lack of relationship skills. The sexual chemistry will often wane as well. So these things can wax and wane, but we help couples determine whether at least initially they had both.
Right. Okay. Okay, so that's an absolute requirement for the relationship to last the road. Is that what you're saying?
That's right, John. Without that, there's nothing we can do. People come in and either they, you know, sometimes they had a great sexual connection, but they didn't even know each other as friends. There was no interest in each other. There was no mutual harmony. Or sometimes it's the other way around. They're best friends, and there's no sexual spark, and never has been.
Right.
And that's tragic. When that happens, it makes it very difficult. But once chemistry is in place, that's the first law of love. The other nine laws simply build on that. The other nine laws are the ways in which we go about preserving and maintaining that initial chemistry.
Okay.
So we can talk a little bit about those. I mean, they function more as a net than a ladder. They're more cyclical than linear. But we've had to set them up in linear fashion because language forces us into lineality, unfortunately.
Right.
Yeah.
So then the next law of love, the second law of love, we call priority, and that's really about prioritizing the health of the relationship and one's own health, especially as they relate to any unaddressed addictions or compulsions or emotional illnesses that might exist. And that can include codependence.
Right.
So this is about
what would you call codependence? Could you explain that to the listeners, Shauna?
Yeah, well, codependence is really a people addiction. It's, you know, the disease to please, as Oprah Winfrey likes to call it. It's the again comes from a very regressed place. It's really the affliction of being overly preoccupied with other people to our own detriment. You're caring too much about another person, and particularly and especially, and this is where the model came from, the early recovery work, for example, if somebody is sick with alcoholism or another problem, when one subordinates their own self-care as a result of being overly preoccupied with controlling or caretaking the so-called sick person. Because preoccupation in and of itself is a form of sickness, and it's a kind of person addiction. And it functions in the exact same way as any, you know, process or chemical addiction functions, which is to distract one from one's own unwanted feelings.
Okay. Okay, I understand. So really, that must be a tough one, because so much of society we're taught that to put our own, you know, our own self-love first is actually selfish.
That's right, John. It is a colossal, a societal misinformation campaign, isn't it? You know, the truth is that unless we're putting ourselves first, unless we're loving ourselves, we really can't love another. Truly.
Right.
We can go through the motions and look like we're loving another. We can look kind, or we can look harmless, or we can look nice. But the idea that for the energy to be aligned, we've got to be loving ourselves. And, you know, love is infinite. So if we're loving ourselves, we've got plenty of love for everybody else. It's not like we're going to run out.
And it's not like we don't need to negotiate and join with other people. But we know, everybody knows, when we get on the plane and they're teaching us how to handle, oxygen problems, that we're taught always to put the mask on our own face first before we put the mask on our children.
Yeah.
Couldn't be more counterintuitive to a mother. She wants to put that mask right on her baby's face first.
Yeah.
But it's just...
Yeah, well, that makes sense, and I think that's sometimes a real tough one, and I think when I saw the amount of codependency in society, it's almost encouraged in some areas, you know?
Well, we say that we consider it, in a way, a phase of human evolution. You know, we were more into survival before, and that was the consuming concern for everybody, to be able to feed ourselves and shelter ourselves and procreate, but now and stay safe on that level. But now it seems that codependence seems to be the current level of preoccupation, whether it's addressed as a healing, on a healing path or not.
Right, and I think a lot of people coming out of recovery from addictions, that's the next thing they have to face, is the codependency, isn't it?
Well, codependence, John, underlies all addictions. In other words, the way we've all become codependent, and I do believe that we all are to some degree codependent, is that we went, as little children, when our needs went unmet, we had no choice but to consider something wrong with us rather than something wrong with our parents.
Yeah, right. Gotcha.
But what we do is we modify or manipulate or try to mold ourselves into that which we believe will get our parents to give us what we think we need from them in order to survive. And all children do that. They become, the good student to get mommy's, approval, or they become the good little dutiful son or daughter, or they become a rebel, or they try to get in trouble, or they do whatever they try to do to try to get their parents' attention and love. And it all comes out of codependence. And so it builds the symptoms, in adulthood, where it's the same. We force ourselves into some kind of an inauthentic position in order to try to get what we think we need from others. And I'm being careful with the way I'm speaking. It's what we think we need, because of course we don't really need that from anybody but ourselves.
Yeah. Yeah, and that realization comes often a long way down the road, doesn't it?
Yeah, these are hard ones. This is hard won wisdom. And I think it leads nicely to the third law of love, which is emotional integrity. Because for all of us, one of the ways out of the trap of codependence is to really learn to recognize and be aware of our own feelings. And I know this is kind of, quite dated in terms of, psychological teachings. But we need to become aware of our own feelings. That means we need to be honest with ourselves. Honest with ourselves. We need to learn how to communicate our emotions to our intimates in a way that is respectful and non-threatening.
And this definitely, the emotion of anger, John, which is the big destroyer in relationships. I mean, anger, it could be argued, is motivated by fear, that when we're frightened or we feel fragmented, we behave in an angry way. Our model makes it very, very simple. We list certain behaviors and actually linguistic construction, language, that indicates acted out anger. And we just tell people, we tell couples and single people, look, the use of these language constructions and these behaviors, will hurt your relationship. They are acted out anger. And until we admit and accept that that's acted out anger and admit that we're working to not do those things, we're going to have trouble in our relationships.
Right. Yeah, that was fascinating when... when I learned through your work that, for example, sarcasm is acted out anger, right?
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, John.
And ridicule. And, you know, when I think of our humor industry, you know, I mean, especially in Britain, you know, it's all based on that. And the tabloid newspapers, you know, I mean, it's everywhere is sarcasm, ridicule, and it's incredible.
That's right. We're shaming people for entertainment.
Well, and in couples, John, very insidious kind of acted out anger is teaching, moralizing, lecturing, unsolicited advice. See, these can seem very gentle. You know, someone's talking about a problem at work or a difficulty they're having with some physical pain, and, you know, the partner starts giving advice or, you know, gives a teaching, a sermon on how, you know, best to exercise or how best to, you know, eat to avoid the problem or whatever it is. And really, it's coming out of a frustration, isn't it? If I'm doing that with Shauna, I'm frustrated. I'm feeling powerless to fix a problem. And so I'm a little frustrated, and I want to just, you know, basically cut it off and give her some advice.
Well, that is a subtle one. I think that'll shock a lot of people.
Yes.
It really does, John. It's very subtle. You see, these are very subtle distinctions. Next thing you know, we're having a fight. And so how did this start? You know, unless we are very clear about the fact that that kind of unsolicited advice, that teaching that I'm giving Shauna without her asking me for it, is actually acted out anger. And in this case, frustration. I'm not, you know, enraged. I'm just mildly frustrated that she's got, say, a physical pain that I can't do anything about.
Right. Okay. So it sounds like that it's almost coming from the inability to control, and that brings on the frustration.
There we go. Exactly. Exactly, it's that essential powerlessness. I can't, you know, I can't make it better. And, you know, we can see it. I can't make it better for my mother or my father, right? I can't, you know, here I am. I'm trying to mold myself into something that's going to make her better. It doesn't work, and so I'm frustrated. So, boom, I give advice. And look, men do this the world over. Men are acting out their anger by giving unsolicited advice every moment of every day, all over the world.
Yeah, we tend to want to fix it all the time.
You do, John. We've been trained, haven't we?
Yeah,
the other
absolutely.
Form of acting out anger that people are very surprised to learn of is guilt trips.
Yeah, that's a horrible one, isn't it?
Yeah, when people guilt trip us or play the victim, it's very insidious because it's manipulating. It manipulates the other person into taking responsibility for oneself. And that's where it's very powerful, it's very effective, and it's actually it's very disrespectful. And, you know, interpersonally, on a subtle energetic level, it's quite violent.
Right.
Because you're really putting somebody in a position of either caretaking you or appearing to be a brute.
Right.
So this is now the
third law, right?
That's
yeah,
right.
We're still talking about being aware of our emotions.
That's emotional integrity, John. And the fourth law of love is called deep listening. And that's all about our ability to listen not only for our partner's words, but really for the emotion under the words. It's really about becoming emotionally attuned to our partner. And it's just a great skill for life as well. To the extent that we're really attuned, we're better parents, we're better bosses, we're better employees, we're better at our life. You know, to the extent we're really able to read the signal, to just get a sense of what this other person's all about. And deep listening is the law where we talk about not only the sort of the ideal, the state of the art, but all the reasons why we're not able to listen to each other. Because none of us are bad people. We're not born not being able to listen. What happens is we get traumatized around listening. We get traumatized around edicts like sit down and shut up.
Yeah.
I mean, how many times have we all heard that?
Wow.
You're
going to,
you know, in a lecture, and you can't say anything. And so when someone's speaking, we literally dissociate, many of us.
Yeah.
We have some very simple exercises that we teach people to make listening safe. I mean, the third law of love makes speaking safe. And the fourth law of love makes listening safe. And remember, we're trying to establish what we call an emotional safe zone in your couple. It's that safe haven experience I was talking about earlier.
Right.
That many of us, most of us, didn't have as children. So we're having a corrective learning experience at the hands of our partner.
Yes.
Right. So we really are becoming co-teachers with each other at this stage.
We are, John.
Indeed.
We really are. And again.
Okay, and where do we move on to there?
Well, that's the fourth law of love. The fifth law of love is called equality. And that's where we handle all the worldly nitty-gritty, all the ways in which we are actually not equal to one another. Remember, very, very few of us are equal to anybody in the world. We all have gifts and talents and abilities and deficits and liabilities that are quite unique. And what the law of equality says is that at the end of the day, all the ways in which the different gifts and talents each of us have and the power that comes from those gifts and talents is experienced by the other person as fair. So if Shauna has the ability, say, to make much more money than I do, we come to the relationship and she's an investment banker and I'm a carpenter, you know, we've got a problem. And it's not insurmountable, but we've got to make sure that the huge difference in power, because she's able to generate, say, millions of dollars from her work and I'm able to generate, you know, tens of thousands with mine, we've got to make sure that different power feels fair to us. So we've got some negotiating to do. We've got to talk about our unconscious expectations for a relationship, for what a family looks like, for who contributes what, the division of labor. So really, it's all about the nitty-gritty of negotiation. It's a tough law. It's actually the law in which most of the content that people bring to our offices comes from. Do you know people have issues around money, they have issues around who does what, they feel that it's unfair. You know, there's a lot of conflict around equality issues.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's one can see that everywhere, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And, so we try to make as much of that conscious as possible. You know, at this place where our work becomes somewhat political, too, I have to say.
Yeah.
You know, because there's a lot of unconscious expectations, assumptions that we have about gender and about, you know, who's going to do what once the kids come along. And, you know, the personal does become political at this point.
Even though we don't have any kind of standard or model that we ask couples to abide by in terms of what's fair in terms of, in heterosexual relationships, what's fair in terms of gender roles, it's completely immaterial to us how any couple identifies or divvies up those roles. We don't care if it looks completely traditional and old-fashioned or it looks unexpected and futuristic. It makes no difference to us. The only thing that matters is that the couple discuss it with each other and both of them think, and the terms are explicit, and they both think that the arrangement is fair, and they will leave the door open to renegotiate if they find over time that one of their agreements doesn't work out so well.
Okay.
But we don't impose. We don't impose, you know, a feminist agenda or a traditional family values agenda on couples or in this law at all.
Right.
We just say you guys figure it out and make sure there are no resentments. And if there are, you're going to go back to the table.
And that's what often happens, John, because as we embark on a path of personal development and do our spiritual work and our personal work, we often find that things that we accepted once upon a time are no longer acceptable.
Yeah.
So we have to
negotiate
those.
It's so essential to have
quality support. Nothing is non-negotiable. We can always go back and renegotiate.
You know, I'm just working with a client who realizes that she's always smiling, but she has a lot of resentment. She thinks things aren't fair in her couple. And she grew up in a war. And her parents were trying to keep her safe. And she never bothered them with her petty issues.
Right.
So she has the habit of trying to be pleasant and making nice because she didn't want to be a burden. But now in her couple, she's not able to be direct about her needs and her dissatisfactions. So she ends up, you know, steaming with resentment and realizing she can't come forward.
I think that's a common one, isn't it?
Yeah,
it is.
Especially, you know, where the female gender has been programmed to be the good little girl and never to complain.
Yeah, very much.
So, I would like to, if you could move along to the rest of these laws, because I want to get as much in as possible, and we're running up to getting close to wrapping up in about 10 minutes. So could you just quickly go through for our listeners the rest of the laws?
Sure.
Certainly, John. The sixth law of love is called peacemaking, and in that law we teach really the technology of conflict resolution, anger management, negotiation, and we have several skills we teach in that law to really help transform that insidious force that we talked about earlier of anger into one of peace.
And so we teach anger management through simple, very, very simple kinds of tools, and also conflict resolution and agreement making. So these are
right.
This is how we manage anger and resolve conflict and prevent future conflict through agreements.
So it's really the technology to establish the emotional safe zone.
Okay.
So the seventh law of love is called self-love. And in this law, we talk about the phenomenon of transference in couples. It happens actually with all people all the time, and that is that phenomenon where we start experiencing our partner as, you know, slowly or rapidly as people that hurt us in the past.
So this is in the power struggle stage of relationship where we're triggered into that child place of experiencing our partner, you know, treating us the way our parents might have treated us. So in terms of, you know, say my father was a workaholic and then Maurice forgets my birthday and all the anger at my father neglecting me will come up and get dumped on Maurice. So that's a very simple example of how that might happen, the transference. And so just as we said for the second phase of relationship, we resolve the power struggle phase of relationship and are able to move into co-creativity. Part of it is learning to listen, and which is the fourth law, and we learn emotional integrity, which is the third law, and we make agreements, which is the fifth law, and then we resolve conflict, which is the sixth law, and now we also are able to identify when we regress and when we transfer onto our partner.
And John, removing those family of origin projections from our partner is the surest route to building our own self-love.
Right.
Now, your course listeners will remember that the course says that there's no perception. There's no perception. There's just projection.
Yeah. There's no other.
Yeah.
So if my father neglected me and I'm angry at Maurice, how am I neglecting myself? That's my first responsibility.
So it really brings everything back to a personal axis, you know, of taking total responsibility for everything, actually. It's really the most powerful spiritual law.
Yeah. So we say 80% of the emotional juice of our worst conflicts has to be with people in the past, and 20% or less is actually a contemporary issue with our partner.
Sometimes with me, John, it's a complete paranoid projection onto Shauna. She's just maybe said something emphatically, assertively, and I'll hear the thundering, critical voice of my father. Boom. Just like,
or your mother, it could be.
Or my mother, it could be. I'm saying in my case, it would be my father, but of course it could be mother, it could be uncle, it could be sister, brother.
Yeah. Right, and then of course, presumably, when we get triggered like that, we then react coming from that little child.
Absolutely.
And then it makes the problem worse, I guess, because then you've got 2 4-year-olds fighting, right?
Exactly.
That's exactly.
Exactly.
It.
Or a 4-year-old and a 13-year-old. You see, we also have an inner teen, which we don't have time to talk about today, but that makes things very complicated, doesn't it? They're both kids, but one has a lot more power.
Right. Yeah, gotcha. I can see that.
Okay.
So then we got the eighth law.
The eighth law of love is called mission in life, and that is where we bring in our work in the world as an essential fundament of healthy relationship. If I'm not doing work in the world that supports me, that makes me feel like whole, that really is the reason I came to planet Earth, our relationship is going to suffer. So our model incorporates this notion of mission in life into a conception of healthy relationship.
And we haven't actually ever seen it before in couple work, and we don't think that it is optional. It's too important to be prioritized.
That is fantastic, because, you know, when you do get fortunate enough to find what you really want to do, I mean, it just sends your energy levels so high, doesn't it?
That's right, John. It is about being energized by the work and proud of the work that we do in the world.
Yeah.
And the world needs
us. And when you think
how
many people are out there not doing what they want to do, I mean, it's tragic, really, isn't it?
It is tragic, and they're role modeling that to their kids, and the world is in dire need of everybody's gifts.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know?
Okay.
So the ninth law of love is called walking, and it's kind of shocking, and, you know, in America, people understand walking means, you know, to leave a relationship. In England, I think it's a little different. That's more like taking a hike in the woods. But we have to clarify that when we're teaching overseas. It's really more about leaving. And it's paradoxical. We're suggesting that, you know, we have to look at our own financial and emotional dependencies, because staying in a relationship out of need rather than desire and passion is a real chemistry killer.
Yeah, that is, I can see that one, yeah. And, of course, traditionally, you know, historically going back, this must have been rife, you know?
That's exactly right, because the relationships were more, in a way, they were more of a business deal.
Yeah, yeah.
You've heard the old quip, I'm sure. If you really love something, set it free.
Yeah,
exactly. If it doesn't come back, you know what I'm saying, right? If it doesn't come back, hunt it down and kill it.
Yeah. That is it.
Are you with me, John?
I am indeed.
That was my attempt at a joke. No, if it doesn't come back, you know, you let it go, and that's part of what's so difficult for us in relationship. I mean, I make a joke, you hunt it down and kill it. That actually probably describes the way most of us think about our partners, you know, freedom to stay in the relationship. You know, that they have to stay somehow, that they owe us. I mean, it's a very, very empowering thing to just imagine letting this person go. And if they want to come back, they can come back. I mean, it really is about facing any place we become emotionally or financially dependent. That's all.
And it's not about being, you know, done and completely. We are interdependent. It's just about being honest. So if I feel, you know, women really need to look at their financial dependencies, because if we are in a situation where we don't think that we could take care of ourselves in a lifestyle that we choose, if we weren't with our partner, then we are going to be in a constant low-grade state of survival panic.
Absolutely.
Which is eating away at our nervous system.
That is so clear.
So it's not about going out.
And also, when you were talking about that concept, it is true that the more you try to hold on to something, the more it goes away, and then when you just release it, it drifts back.
Exactly, right. John. If it's supposed to come back, it comes back.
Exactly.
And if not, then that's, you know, then we've got some grief to do, don't we? I mean, it's very hard for most of us to grieve.
Yeah. So the very last law of love, the 10th law of love, is called transformational education. And that's really a couple's agreement to do whatever learning and healing work is necessary to keep the chemistry alive. In a way, it's a fail-safe law of all the 10 laws of love. It just says, if, you know, if the problem for one of us is a problem for both of us.
Yeah.
And that we will, you know, we will do whatever, we'll go to whatever workshops. We'll do bibliotherapy, we'll listen to wonderful radio programs, we'll do whatever is necessary to address and heal the problems that we have in our relationship so that we maintain our best friendship and our sexual connection.
And that's a wonderful, wonderful part of the work you do, and I want to publicly acknowledge you, because I know you guys are so committed to that. And you know, out there, I mean, it can be a minefield, this work you do, you know. And you know, so many people go to, there's different therapists and counselors and coaches, and very often they're not doing their own clearing work, and that can be very, very destructive. That's what my experience has been.
No, that's a profound truth, John.
It really is, John. It's the most operational principle. I don't care what somebody's orientation is, you know, what modality or technique or, you know, approach they use. I mean, if they're not doing their personal work, and I've seen people with, you know, with lots and lots of major degrees who aren't doing their own work, and, you know, are ineffectual. In the same way, I have to say, you know, I've seen, you know, several healers that are, you know, basically untrained in proper, you know, Western methods, who are phenomenally gifted and who do their work and, you know, are very practitioners of, you know, high degrees of integrity. So it really is the operational principle, you know, or variable that separates people that are, you know, going to be helpful from people that just aren't.
Well, that's fascinating. Now tell me, tell the listeners now, if you could, the names of your books.
Yes, our hardcover book, and our hardcover in the U.S. is The New Couple, and it's actually coming out in paperback later this year. And we also have the international soft cover of The New Couple, and we have another small book, which is a much shorter book called What's the State of Your Union? Instant Relationship Self-Diagnosis. And it's a condensation of The New Couple. It's made much more simple, and it's shorter, and so that has that.
It's like a self-diagnosis, that one, Sean, is it?
Yes, you can go. You quickly go through the laws, and you can assess your relationship.
Okay.
So that's a new book, but that's available now, and I think it's available through Amazon right now. And in terms of distribution, that's going to be happening probably later in the summer.
Okay. And how can our listeners get you? Could you give your website out?
It's newcouple.com. That's www.newcouple, newcouple.com.
Fantastic. Okay, well, Sean and Maurice, thank you so much for coming on today. It's been fascinating. It's a lot of information, and I think that people out there, you know, I really encourage you to take a look at the books, read the books, go to Sean and Maurice's website, because their work is amazing work, and it's so needed right now on the planet. And as you always say, you know, a healthy individual ends up, you know, spreading out to the rest of the world. So thank you for coming on and giving us your time this afternoon, and I wish you well and lots of luck to you both.
Thank you, John. Congratulations on your wonderful show.
Okay. Thank you, guys. Take care now. Bye-bye now. I can see that you're not ready.